So let's talk about privacy with this little guy over here. So there's a lot of privacy options available to you in life. If you want to sleep, you can close your curtains. If you want to go outside, you can wear sunglasses. And if you want to go on the internet, you can use Tor. Browsing the web with Tor gives you anonymity and privacy, but Tor has attacks. These attacks are becoming more and more motivated because as we live in a more digitized age, the attackers want more and more of your information online. So I'm Taiwan, and today I'm going to be talking to you about a specific line of attacks called website fingerprinting. Website fingerprinting, we have new attacks and proof of defenses for website fingerprinting. This is joint work with my supervisor, Ian Goldberg. We're from the University of Waterloo, as well as a research group from SUNY Brook University, Xiang Chai, Rishabh Nivanand, and Rob Johnson. So what is website fingerprinting? I'm going to try to be describing it with an analogy. Let's say we have the client and the server who want to talk to each other through those two walls, and they're going to be using this mind-blowing new technology called two paper cups on a string. Now, suppose the attacker will be sitting between those two walls and will be trying to determine what they're talking about. So which is to say the attacker is a local passive eavesdropper and they want to and they're trying to look at your packet sequences. So thanks in part to encryption and Tor's own padding scheme and Tor's website fingerprinting defenses, the attacker cannot tell the frequency or intensity of this vibration. However, the attacker can still see the packet timing and the packet directions, and the attacker will throw that into a website fingerprinting classifier. So our attack, which will be represented with this awesome X here, will be is shown to be much faster than previous attacks. We are about 3,000 times faster than previous best attack. It is more accurate than previous best attacks, and it is also more effective in the open world. So this is a bit of a difficult concept. Let me try to describe what the closed world means with a story, the complement of the open world. Suppose you were a student, and you, of course, you took a lot of exams, and they could often be very difficult. But no matter how difficult they were, you could always be certain, hopefully certain, that the exam covers material from a fixed and relatively small syllabus. So the exam won't ask you questions outside of the syllabus. So if you study well for the exam and you prepare your materials well, you can take advantage of this situation and always be able to do well in this exam. Or you can cheat. And so that was the closed world. What is the open world? The open world is like when after you graduate, anyone can at any time ask you questions about any field, even fields that you have no knowledge about. And at some point, you're going to have to say, I have not studied this field. I don't really know much about this. I don't know the answer to this question. That's an open world classifier. Translating that to website fingerprinting, a closed world classifier is able to answer and distinguish within a fixed set of web pages, whereas a open world classifier should be able to answer, this is a non-monitored page, I don't really care about this page, or I don't know about this page, it is outside of my purview. So, but it should still be able to distinguish between monitor sites. So what is our attack? Our attack uses the K nearest neighbors classifier, which is just about the simplest classifier you can think of. Suppose the question marks here are the testing points, and the color circles are the training points. You simply look at the neighbors of each testing point and take majority. So in this case, K equals 4, and you can color the circles pretty easily. So because of its simplicity, it actually has a great number of advantages. It has no training time. It has sublinearly increasing testing time. It's non-parametric. And also, especially for website fingerprinting, it has this multimodal property that's really nice for us. What is the multimodal property? Some classes are multimodal in the sense that they contain different, a class could contain several clusters of points that are far away from each other. In some sense, they should have been different classes, but they got the same label somehow. Parametric solutions could deal very poorly with those because they violate the parametric assumptions, but the k-nearest neighbors classifier doesn't really care. If you unite those, if you have a union of several of those clusters, the k-nearest neighbors classifier only cares about the neighbors of the cluster. So if you have enough points, it's perfectly fine. Why is this multimodal property important for us? Well, web pages are often multimodal because, for example, Google would have different localization versions depending on where you're visiting from, and your user settings like JavaScript or having caches could change whether, which web page version you're getting. And without expert knowledge, this can be really hard to deal with. It will really lower accuracy, but if you just use the k-nearest neighbors classifier, you can deal with these pages without having to train specifically for that. So central to the operation of this K-nearest neighbors classifier is the notion of neighbors. And neighbors means distance. How do you define the distance between two packet sequences? So for example, can you say that packet sequences from Reddit and YouTube are similar simply because they're both cat worshiping websites? So we define distance with this notion by drawing fixed length feature vectors from these packet sequences. Our features include five categories. We have total time, we have packet counting, we do packet directions, we try to identify the concentrations of the packets, and we try to find bursts of continuous packets within the same direction. So these features total up to about 3,700 features, and we're going to have to rely on the distance training mechanism to filter down to the important features. So we tried using the Euclidean distance on this feature vector, but it didn't work very well. So we wrote our own distance training mechanism. We are going to learn a weighted taxicab sum, which can be represented by this formula. We are trying to learn a wi where I goes up to like 3,700, which will be eventually multiplied to the absolute difference of feature values. The way we learn wi is to rely on each point to provide a vote, a recommendation on how the weights should change. And there will be a central mechanism that says we are going to, this is what the final weights will be. The principle each point uses to determine its weights is that it will recommend the weights that makes itself easiest to classify. So, and that will make, hopefully, when we collect all of those points, those recommendations, all points will be easy to classify. Recall that we have this multimodal property in the K-nearest neighbors classifier, which we really want to preserve. But this creates a bit of a dilemma, because we want two points from two different clusters. We don't want them to be close to each other, so we don't need distance training to force them to be close to each other. However, without knowing the distance, how can we know where the clusters are? So we have this catch-22 situation. Distance training should be done on close points, but close points are informed by distance training. How do we resolve this? The way we resolve this is to do an iterative process. So rather than simply doing a single vote, each point will turn by turn give the recommendations to the system. The distance will be changed after the recommendations, and the next point will iteratively decide the recommendations on the new distance. So the distance will be recomputed over and over again until it converges to a nice value. Let's try to see the let's try to evaluate this process. So we collected 100 circles, 9,000 circles, 100 colors, 90 circles each. They're monitor sites, 100 different colors. So these different web pages are collected from ban lists from the UK, from Saudi Arabia, from China. They're sensitive sites of political, religious nature. And also 9,000 gray circles, the non-monitor sites from Lexis Top, and they will help inform the classifier what a non-monitor site should look like. The way we evaluate accuracy is to do leave one out classification. We simply cover up one circle, we cover up the color, and then we ask the classifier, what is the color of the circle I just covered? And we do this one by one until it goes through the whole list. And so we get accuracy values. The central principle we use for classification here is that if there is no consensus among the neighbors, then we classify it as a non-monitor point. This is a very conservative approach, and it helps drive down the false positives. So in this case, even if you have a majority of your neighbors being a monitored page, just because you have a gray circle next to you, we will say that you are a non-monitor page. So we need that to trade off false positive rate for true positive rate. Having this principle gives us two parameters we can vary in order to get a good accuracy value. The first parameter is the number of gray circles. If you increase the number of gray circles, it becomes more likely you evaluate a point as a non-monitor point. The second parameter is the number of neighbors. If you increase the number of neighbors, it's harder to reach a consensus, and therefore it's more likely to classify a point as a non-monitor point as well. So varying those two parameters, we get a series of values on true positive and false positive rate, which will join this curve. We draw a Pareto orthogonal curve over them. Notice the y-axis is logarithmic, and the x-axis is linear. Two particular points I would like to point your attention to are the true positive rate 85%, gives us a false positive rate of 0.6%, as well as if we can take down the true positive rate by about 10%, we can have a false positive rate of 0.1%, which is very nice for us. But not for Tor. So if we compare to the previous best attack, we can see that our newest attack has a false positive rate that is about 10 times better than the previous attack, 10 to 60 times better. And in fact, if you compare with older attacks where the analysis was only done on a small problem size, it may seem that they have a good false positive rate, but increasing the problem size by 100 times would also increase the false positive rate by 100 times. So this, in fact, we have a much better false positive rate than the previous best attacks. Why do I keep talking about this false positive rate thing? Why is it important to us? Well, because of the context of website fingerprinting, the base instance rate of visiting a monitor site could be very low. Now, if you have, for example, a 1% base instance rate, then for the old attack, you will be overwhelmed with false alarms, so you can't really do anything about your attack, whereas for our new attack, you still have the vast majority of your alarms will still be true. So I mentioned those two parameters we could vary. Let's look at the first parameter, the number of gray circles to Surian. We varied that from about 50 to 5,000. And notice that the y-axis, the false positive rate decreases very quickly, whereas there isn't much of a change in true positive rate. So it's generally positive for us to have more gray circles in the classifier to inform the classifier what the non-monitor site looks like. Whereas we also changed the number of neighbors to use. So recall that increasing number of neighbors makes it harder to reach a consensus. Here we see we can also decrease the true positive rate, but there's a much decrease the false positive rate, but there's a much greater sacrifice in a true positive rate, which is not as good. So still, we have this very powerful attack. It's very effective. It may be threatening to some users. And the idea that you might be thinking right now is, can we defend against this attack? Can we break this attack by, for example, making its distance learning mechanism go crazy? Or can we cover up some features that it might use? And I would say this: while this is a common approach in this field, it may not be the correct approach. This is because in research, we have a lot of defenses that say, we have managed to defeat a certain attack. And so they publish their results. But then later on, they get broken up by more powerful attacks. But in practice, you can't rely on that. In practice, you must, when you're sending web traffic, you must choose a defense. And the attacker then will collect this web traffic. And they get infinite time to choose the best possible attack to break your defense. This is not good for us. So what we need is this notion of a provable defense, a defense that is effective against all possible classification attacks. How do we do this? Well, the more clever of you might already be thinking of a provable defense. What if, for the the Tor entry guard and the client, they simply shout at each other at maximum volume, which is to say, they flood the channel with fake packets, and when they need to send real packets, they simply replace some of those fake packets with real packets. Because of encryption, the attacker, the local passive attacker, can't tell between real packets and fake packets, so that's really good. It's a provable defense. This is a provable defense, but it's not something Tor would really like. This is because Tor is bandwidth-starved. You don't want to flood Tor channels because you deny other people the chance to use Tor, and Tor will be angry, and you wouldn't like Tor when it is angry. But we can take this idea of covering traffic, and we can just tone it down a bit so we can try to reach bandwidth optimality. The idea is that you should send your real traffic as a subsequence of a covering packet sequence. So the covering packet sequence should be sent for multiple different packet sequences from different web pages, and it would be a super sequence. The keyword here is super sequence. So if you have a super sequence of your covering traffic, that is good. And in fact, to reach bandwidth optimality, all we need to do is to solve the shortest common super sequence problem, which is entirely tractable for small numbers of subsequences. And it seems that we have a good solution. It's bandwidth optimal, and it's what we can do to cover your traffic. However, what we may have forgotten here is that we don't actually know what packet sequence we're going to get. It's not possible to compute a super sequence of something that you don't even know. So that's a bit of a problem here. Unless, of course, you're allowed to cheat and you have clairvoyant abilities. We have several levels of information here that represent how much you can cheat from no information to full information. So if you have no information, you have a different strategy. Rather than computing a super sequence on the fly, you're going to have one super sequence that you're going to use for all of your traffic, perhaps a super sequence that's provided by Tor, for example. This super sequence will try to be bandwidth optimal for your users. If you have some information about the web page that you're about to visit, you can actually use a different strategy. You can have multiple super sequences, and given your information about the web page, you'll choose the super sequence that gives you the lowest possible overhead. And with this, you might be able to save on the overhead, but how to incorporate this web page information into a choice remains a difficult problem. Now, of course, you have full information, it becomes a lot easier. You can compute the super sequence while you're trying to load the page, and you can use as many covering packet sequences as you want, given your anonymity level. So we drew curves for all of these three levels of information. The x-axis is the maximum accuracy of any possible attack, and the y-axis is the bandwidth overhead. So we have quite a large bandwidth overhead here. For no information and site information, it's about 60 to 90%, whereas for full information, it's quite a bit lower. So full information represents a theoretical maximum for this line of probable defenses. So this would be the final slide of the talk. Let's pit our attack against our provable defense. What are we going to get here? So since our provable defense is, in fact, provable, our attack, looking at the last two rows, cannot break our defense. It achieves an accuracy that's lower than the maximum accuracy that we are allowing, even though the overhead is a little big. But if you look at the first two rows, for example, it is able to achieve a really good accuracy on previously good defenses. And in fact, what's also surprising is that for the third row, decoy pages, which is where you load one real page with one decoy page every time, we can still achieve a pretty good accuracy. What's important to emphasize here is that there's no maximum accuracy on those defenses, and you can, in fact, achieve a better accuracy than this if you have bear attack. Whereas for provable defenses, you will never have more. No attack can achieve more accuracy than that. So the central takeaway I'm going to give here is that website fingerprinting attacks can and will continue to break unproven defenses until we get proven defenses that are effective and bandwidth optimal. Thanks for listening to my talk, and I will have any questions. Thank you.
We've got some time for questions now.
Hi, my name is Tom Arm from Salesforce. Can you talk a bit more about the specific features that you use to build up your K-nearest neighbor graphs?
Yes. Features, here we go. So it's the design principle behind those features is that we're trying to be as exhaustive as possible. So we have a lot of features that may not even work very well on Tor, but we collect a large amount of features from previous works like Panchenko's at, I think it was WPS, and we try to be as enumerative as possible because we trust our distance learning mechanism to focus on only the features that are important. This particular approach also has another advantage, which is that it breaks defenses automatically. So if a defense only reveals one or two features, then it would the distance learning mechanism would find those two features and focus on them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks.
So in your last slide, you talked about accuracy.
Yes.
So I have a two-part question. Is that the technical term of accuracy, or do you mean something else like the area under the receiver operating curve? And then the second thing is, in your models where you have these features, which ones are sort of rated higher for determining different types of websites?
Okay, good questions. So for accuracy, it's the accuracy of guessing the web page correctly. So here the accuracy is, even if you use those defenses, we can try to guess the accuracy. We can try to guess which web page you're visiting. So that would be, it is a traditional definition of accuracy. And so which of those are rated highly? So we found, surprisingly, that the burst feature, so there's a number of general approaches, like the total number of packets, the total amount of time, the number of outgoing packets, which are always very important because web pages don't change them very often. But we also found, surprisingly, that the burst features were quite important, which is continuous streams of packets going to the same direction. These seem to characterize a web page pretty well. Thank you.
Is there any other questions? OK, I have one question, which is sort of what kind of assumptions are you making about the passive attacker and how much they know about the behavior of the user that they're targeting, or is this kind of something that could be done in a large untargeted way?
That's a great question. So again, part of the design philosophy, I guess, is that we want to have this multimodal thing where even without expert knowledge, you could still train your attack. If you collect enough data from different clusters, you can still train your attack against those different clusters. So you don't need to know which element the client is in, which cluster the client is in, but you can sort of focus on that automatically. So, but we don't have solid results on, for example, if the attacker collected from this particular data set and the client was using another type of setting that the attacker never knew about, we are not sure if if there would be a good accuracy. However, we would point out that, for example, Tor browser bundle really recommends that you don't change any of its settings, so there might not be a lot of different settings. But for example, distance might be a factor that we cannot really deal with. Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.